Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the old chestnut of who's at the center of the universe or the center of all things. Now, you might feel it should be you, or you might feel someone else who thinks that it shouldn't be them, or should be anyone, or it should be everyone, or some sort of combination of that type of thing. So it mightn't be the universe, it might be the social world, the physical world, all sorts of little permutations to that. So it's an old chestnut, and the old idea of a chestnut is that you never really answer it. However, you may actually want to speak to different people who are guaranteed to give you an answer. So if you speak to a priest, they have their book of answers, and strangely, every question leads to the same set of answers, which leads to a basic reflection on you, what you have to physically do. Or if it's not a priest, you might want to pay a psychologist, and a psychologist has a certain amount of their clients who will be upset if they don't get told what to do. So in general, psychologists can tend to tell you what to do. Good ones won't, but sort of the cheaper fly-by-night ones will tell you what to do. Or probably the worst system is to consult with friends on this. If you have a circle of friends, they'll invariably have an agenda, whether they explicitly or implicitly or whatever they are. In their world construct, they'll give you an answer, which means that you will go into their world construct a little bit. So be warned, and perhaps be warned not to listen to this, because this is an explanation, a sort of a scientific explanation. And the problem with scientific explanations is that they tend to sort of explain one thing but ask more and more questions, or they get you confused. They say, what are all the different events from? Now, the basis of this is generally, I have to keep on going back to this, is why I'm doing this and why this is this quality and why it's like this. I'm doing general cognitive rehab. So what happens is I do have a question go into my mind, and I sort of plan to speak about it. That sort of planning means I've got to remember things, put things together, control breathing and voice and pronunciation and all those sorts of thousands and one things that ticks a few boxes and leaves a few other boxes open. So as I've sort of intimated that it is an old chestnut, and that's an old chestnut, you're not going to get a good answer. Well, you can get a good answer, but you're not going to get it from a definitive answer from a scientist. Now, what I'd like to do is for you to initially picture a Venn diagram. I'm actually going to expand the answer. And this is essentially what scientists do. They, part of a research methodology, they do literature reviews. You make sure the question is asked properly to go across. So I'm going to do a Venn diagram and start off with a Venn diagram joke from New Scientist. And it was this. You're so Venn, you probably think this diagram is about you. I found who actually sang that song. Was it Helen Reddy or something like that? I can't really remember. And then they had a Venn diagram, and the Venn diagram is those who understand Venn diagrams, those who are really fantastic, and the intersection of those people are really fantastic and can understand Venn diagrams. And it was actually, you know, sort of a self-reflexive things. But for this Venn diagram, we can say that there's different attributes of centre. There's sort of centre, sort of system centre, sort of natural system centre, sort of biological centre. Then something very, not so much a different concept, but it's sort of slightly different. That's social centre of things, which sort of may explain a few bits and pieces. And then there's the physics center. What is the physics center? And I have to tell you that the physics center is probably the most surprising answer that you'll probably probably get. So those are three different aspects to go into. And unfortunately, the first two aren't all that clear. But you can imagine a fable of different animals plucked out of the big ecosystem chart on a schoolroom That thing with the little arrows going in, the sun coming in and putting energy, and it goes in a circle, decomposes, and first primary, or was it top level predators, first level consumers, second level consumers, it all goes. Imagine those animals came out and they all had an argument about which is best. And so the eagle says, "I'm the best," and then something else says, "I'm there," and they have an argument, and the argument goes on and on and on. And in effect, there's, to cut this long story short, there's actually no one which is the actual best in the top, because it is actually a system. However, there are these key things that if you make human decisions and interact with that system, in general, you'll wreck it. And the case in point is the wolves from Yellowstone Park. They remove the wolves, and then the soil erosion, because the deers multiplied out and ate and did all these things. Now, the important thing is that they've got in there is that although something is the centre of a system, not necessarily the centre of a system, things can have a climate or landscape of fear. So what would that mean? Just having one or two wolves really had no effect on the deer population, but it meant that there's no deer would actually go out into the large meadow, and it meant that the meadows would recover, they would have less hoof prints on, and it stabilised the system. And often what happens here is your things do have a sort of a system effect at many, many different levels, and you'd have to go in and see it to try and work it out. Now, that's just an overall point, probably doesn't say all that much in terms of just, I suppose, a warning. Don't go in and say one thing is the centre of a system. There's sort of many layers of knowledge to it. We come into the social system, and we come back to Clausewitz, a military person who said, obviously, the word centre, and you obviously would, I suppose, if you Google research this, I haven't researched this, is just off the top of my head. But he talked about centre of mass. This is a central idea that everyone is locked to and orchestrates everything in a society. So it might be wealth or fame, a central idea, and that was called the centre of mass. So you have to understand what the centre of mass is and act on that centre of mass. So it's sort of, again, a sort of system, but much higher level sort of system. You've got the idea of social hierarchy. So rather than actually a complex system, you've got a system within a society, and there's a social hierarchy. And you do have these things that you come up with a list, and someone reorders the list because they have an insight into what is the centre of mass or who's the person. So it's basically, you could produce a report for high-level stuff, but it's the customer who's got the money will not understand this, and they want to know certain things and don't want to know certain things. So they want to know the house is in the right suburb and stuff like that. They don't want to know that there's termites about the place or some other aspects. So someone can come in and rephrase it, recenter it. So if you can really think of the center of mass as a force, and that force gets applied to what you see, and it puts it across. Now, this is slightly close to what people see. They sort of, there's certain things about how you perceive yourself in a society, and what you believe that you have to do, and what you believe people have to do for you. And essentially, the people at the top or centre of a situation, the king of a society, king or queen, will be in the central hut, and you'll have people further out. So environmental factors, like people coming in, they have to go and they have to fight to get to the king. The king's in the centre. And it's most important to convince the king. And so the king, there's an asymmetric way of understanding. If the king gives a half coherent order, the servants have to understand it. But if the servants say the same half coherent thing backwards, the same flow of information backwards, it's their fault. And so the onus of clarity and logic and questions. And so what often happens is that people, bit by bit, if they actually can't earn their way up there, they actually start to invent and create a hierarchy around themselves, and you've got to like it, lump it or leave it. Now, I just want to pull back to the biological and social thing and say, look, there's a link here, and this is the fact that whether a behavior is actually inbuilt into the environment and the organism learns the behavior and goes to it is an important thing. So what I want to do is go back to the T-Rex, which is backwards in time, and the T-Rex is this big the teeth on this big 5 meter tall, so this is, you know, it would be as big as a building walking past. It wouldn't be, you know, sort of as big as an elephant or something like that. It's sort of halfway, so it's sort of big, but it's not, you know, Godzilla big. And these ones existed in North America only. The T-Rexes are only around California, Nevada, down from Canada, down that stretch. Didn't involve anywhere else, so... Okay, that's evolution, animal. And this is important because T-Rexes are the centre of museums, but they're also the centre of that particular system. I don't want to actually go into whether it's the centre or not, but you could believe, like, wolves, they're the centre of it in the terms that they shaped it. What I want to say is perhaps the environment that they created had a memory of it and shaped them, because... as we dig up the bones, we have sort of like a binary things, bits and pieces hopping in and out. So the rather than a linear progression of T-Rexes, we have this. The T-Rexes were they were diminutive, small sort of animals in Jurassic, and so you've got the Jurassic. And Cretaceous is the third period, and Cretaceous finished with the big piss you off with a big meteor hit. That's right. And all this time you had T-Rexes in this small, fairly small section up of North America. I could be wrong. I just read a book on T-Rexes. The important fact here is that T-Rexes would last a couple of million years, and then another dinosaur would come in on the same body plan as T-Rex. And so, say you had a T-Rex 50 million years ago, and the T-Rex 40 million years ago, the T-Rex 40 million years ago was co-evolving beside T-Rex in another niche, and has moved into the niche. The actual body design and structure of the T-Rex was actually not in the genetics, but in the actual environment itself. Like, if you had all the animals hiding from such a way that only a T-Rex could eat it, you'd have to evolve to something fairly similar to a T-Rex to do it. And so you sort of get this in bosses, you know, bad box. So this happened across here. So... I suppose if I can go here, the actual evolutions, there's the actual knowledge, and you see this as also read a book on Tasmanian devils, and Tasmanian devils, the same niche is the same. There's wolverines and not badgers, but there's sort of scavengers. I've forgotten the other types, but in every continent, so there's an African version of the Tasmanian devil. It's the same one. And let's say the Tasmanian tigers are the same level as a dog. And these they go into the same niche and evolved the same way. So in terms of bad nightmare bosses, you have an intrinsically bad system, and it means that certain bad bosses get brought up, and you remove one, and you may replace it with a good boss, but within the boss after that will be equally bad for the same sorts of corrupt reasons. When we say thinking of bad bosses, they tend to limit what you can present to them. They have a limit of understanding, and you can't smart your way through things. So this, you're very much aware that if you can see ways through systems and solutions, and there's a combination that they're the boss and they don't understand, end of story. And so they are the center of things, even though they're the social center, even though the solution center is somewhere else. And there's always this this tension, and this tension sometimes is a destructive tension. So you tend to focus on it. So if I can say sort of the worst boss in history would be Donald Trump, and there's a whole series of things, and he listens to the screams, and he does the worst thing that imaginable. You know, he walks out of the climate treaty. He does trade sanctions. He's irrational. And that, the reason is that a little bit because that's a sort of an inverse way of being. By being the center, you sort of create a void around yourself. You wreck, and it takes so much power and energy to manage the nightmare going on that you push into it. So that's a sort of the social system. Now, on a personal system, you have a sort of a concept of what you want to do and how you want to negotiate with yourself, sort of an outside of body center, that is, you want to achieve something cooperatively with someone. They may be thinking of themselves at the center, but you sort of can wrap around it. And this is all good, but what's really complex is people's perceptions and sort of game plans. So if they have a game plan which requires more and more in feedback to continuous, like an addictive feedback, they'll go off the rails. Or you can have neurological problems that, do I know all about this topogram? Your personality can change. You can get a knock in the head, a change in diet, change in power structure. So you may have a family power structure change or a work power structure change. And if it's all sort of confused in the way it's structured, it may mean a small little set of shifts which leads to a large set of shifts in front of you. And if you've got the sort of competing balancing centers, it can be out of balance and you can really push for it. Now, given that there are some things that you can change, some things you can't change, particularly if people are actually fallen into their own center. They've actually believed that they're there. Now, you can see, oh my God. Oh gosh, these black cockatoos, pretty beautiful big black cockatoos. And of course, the these real revolting birds called noisy miners were going after them. Sort of and there's a white sulfur-crested cockatoo going on. And that sort of is a little bit of the story and the drama of where you've got to push your centre around. And in terms of, like, you want to be the centre of your area, you know it's expensive, so you're pushed out and your centering is a response to the... I've just seen the birds, I can't explain it too much, but it's a cascade effect. So you've got these things of, you've got the external system mathematically continues, where you've got more and more feedback and things change. There's a thing called catastrophe theory, that is where things are kept in balance, but it can have one set of equations leading to sort of an orbit in one series of surface, and then a system can go, it can go through chaos and reorganize at a different equilibrium, things orbiting around its space. So things, there's a lot of maths and interest in it, and there's a lot of biology, you know, like getting older, systems changes, you know, in brain waves. You can, you know, you've got a brain going into it. It can be elements of dementia, diet, all that sort of thing. Can you control it? In certain, like, you can be lucky that people can be a bit detached from it, be able to control it, so they need a bit of space from what they've got to have perspective for where they're going. And there's a Chinese philosopher from the 3rd century BC called Chuang Tzu, Taoist, and he said something along these lines, and it's having an empty boat that is in a busy river. These people go, call it the Yellow River, the people are going back and forth, and there's a whole lot of sort of argy-bargy going around. Like, get out of the way! And there's a bit shouting and stuff like that. And then an empty boat comes past, and no one shouts at it, and it just moves across. And, you know, why didn't they shout? Well, there's no one to shout at. It's going there anyway. And so there's a bit of a sort of all this philosophy coming in about empty boat, not trying to do things always gracefully, compromising and going out. So just in summary on this biological aspect, one is that people cannot, not necessarily see what's going on. They can get locked into it by being too close to why they're centered. There's a lot of risky factors that you could do. You obviously, if you go to a priest, the answer there is like written, yeah, you going up into a yes house to get the answer yes, or a no house to get the answer no. You go to a cross house and get the answer the sign of the cross. Psychologists go in, what they essentially want to do is get you addicted to psychologists, and essentially you can pick one, then the other, and it takes probably 3 or 4 psychologists to work through to get a professional one who isn't trying to peddle themselves and stuff like that. Going to friends to help is also so dangerous, because they have a world view and they can't, very rarely do they actually give you frank advice that doesn't wind up you being a better friend of them, or say if they were a car salesman, you'd be buying a car from their car yard as part of the great solution, another satisfied customer. So this brings us on to the last part of the talk, and that is the centre. You know, there's that centre there is a social centre, Clausewitz's centre of mass, sort of conceptual centre, and what makes people work. This is the centre of society with a hierarchy. So if someone at the top, is an asymmetric in terms of what you have to prove or not to them. And then surely there is a centre of the universe. And, you know, physically, who is the centre? You know, that surely should be an important question. And to this question, rather than a prescribed answer, we came up with more and more maths. And we had this idea, and it's so true, that nowhere is a centre, and in fact, everyone is the centre of the universe. And it sort of goes back, so I'm changing track. The two parts of the podcast don't really add up together, but the second half really is a bit more profound and a bit more relieving, I suppose, might be the story. So, in the Big Bang started at subatomic size and expanded to roughly the size of a pea, and that expansion is called inflation. So, that the inflation in the universe is when it goes from a tiny point to a big point. Now, it's not a pea as if I could hold a pea. Actually, it is a point, and everything is inside that point. And that point has expanded, and what actually happens is that every person, every consciousness, has a sense of now, and that sense of now is the center of the universe. And let me try and explain it. The very bridge of your nose, I suppose, where the eyes see things a bit. I suppose when the moment the light hits the retina, that would be the you know, my instance of now. Sort of a small fraction of a second here. You have your watch on your wrist and you hold it right up to your face. But if you move it away, the watch moving away subtly redshifts, and the ticks slow down a bit. And it goes to 3 nanoseconds slow. You bring it up to your face again, it speeds up as it's coming away. And so your now is the most recent part of the universe from your perspective, and all other parts of the universe are more distant and more old. And the thing on the moon is 1 second old, and the sun is 8 minutes old. Jupiter's, I think Saturn's 15 minutes old. Can't be 15 minutes more, I don't know. Probably 3/4 of an hour. Alpha Centauri is 4 hours old. And what we did is that it's pitch black and you get night vision goggles, you can see in the dark. And what happened in 1952, Sputnik went up, and they said, "Oh, gee whiz, we're going to be able to have a network of mobile phones." Now, this is a story to this. This is the first night vision goggle, and the first night vision goggle was a pixel, and it was a mobile phone. Now, it's a mobile phone the size of a house. It was not only the size of a house; it looked like a house, but it was a house on rails and. With sort of a big open door pointing up into space, and that door was the horn of the antenna, and it was going to survey space to work out what part of space that it could use. And to their shock, when they went on, they heard this psh, obviously like a continuous psh. I've got a bit of a sound to it all, but it's continuous. And they pointed up there, and they thought, "Well, look, there's something wrong. It must be some bird poo." So they got this one person with, I imagine, a butter knife, go out and remove the pigeon shit, because it was a house and a big pigeon roofing thing. And he went out and removed the pigeon shit, switched on the thing. Obviously didn't butter his toast, I suppose. I hope he didn't. Got a bit of a bird pooey sandwich, a bit of toast. And, oh, crap, it's not crap. And then they began to point around. So surely it could be, and no matter where they pointed it, it was shh. And this shh, in fact, was an audio version of microwave radiation. And when they made a camera, which you can see into the microwave, they made this amazing discovery that we have this sort of cloud layer at a certain height, and at 46 billion light years away, 46,000 million light years away, is the edge of the universe. We are, in fact, in a ping pong ball. We are in this huge ping pong ball, and a lot of this doesn't get taught in school because no teacher has actually bothered to actually, if they've gone to the website and read through the website to work out what has gone. It's actually perfectly white. And if you were able to increase the contrast of your computer by a factor of 10 or more, 10,000, you'd be able to see a slight shift in it. And it's pretty much dead. We're dead in the center of it. However, there's a little bit more to it. We can actually see that we are moving. Okay, and that's moving, and there's a red shift and a blue shift of it. Now, teachers will deny this 100%. That is, they prefer to argue with you rather than actually read through the NASA report. So what's happened is that this first 52 went up. Around the early 80s, 86, they put up the first satellites, and then these cameras, and these beautiful cameras could see the white, that they had to see the tiniest ripples in this white stuff. And they discovered that this phenomena comes of redshift, blue shift occurs in your movement. If you move, run and move, you red and blue shift, and effectively the edge of the universe always moves such that you're always in the center of the universe. Now, I'm just going to finish off the story. Of course, the Germans with ESA put up the Max Planck telescope, and they actually took a picture of the first, it's the fireball of the Big Bang. And the fireball of the Big Bang, the story is that we're actually in this huge microwave oven, 92 billion light years across, round, just sort of that from side to side. It's 220 yotto meters. Yotta is, I think, 824 to... look, I have to really, really remember the distance there. So this is something I want to nail off in education. Now, let's take a look at this. This is rather interesting because it starts to actually get you through. Now, a lot of the teachers cut through this type of stuff. They tell students about the watch not changing as they move further away. In fact, what they teach in schools is from the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages had this concept of absolute time, and it's called angel time, developed quite logically by St. Thomas Aquinas, but incorrectly. Like, there was no experiments prove Einstein right, St. Thomas Aquinas, Einstein 1, St. Thomas Aquinas 0. And it's been going like that. He's remained at zero, angel time, choirs of angels and stuff like that. However, he's been the go-to man for when I explain it to the kiddies. And the kiddies, and then furthermore, when I explain the microwave background and what people can see, teachers basically massive fail. They do not teach this. I just want to go on the Max Planck one. A beautiful thing, the size of a fridge, I suppose, with these two single-pixel high frequency. So you've got a megapixel. It's a single. It's a double pixel, I suppose, might be where it takes one pixel at one side of the sky and measures the reverse side of the sky and rotates around. And so it's sort of like this, you can imagine a scribe, someone who's scratching your Duco of your car. I'm going to recolor your car by scratching the Duco. So scratch the Duco of space around and around. It took, I think, 7 years to take one photograph. And it was a fantastically detailed photograph. And what it sort of showed is this quantum fluctuation of a very small point. So when you get down to really small scales, space is so small, it's all bubbling like a hop cup of Milo or something like that. It's all bubbling and going like this. And this bubble just went right bang. It's like a fly and you swat it. And the Big Bang swatted this quantum fluctuation and it's covered the entire inside of this ping pong ball, which we're all in, and we are stuck in sort of like this magic travelator, which keeps every individual in the center of the universe. So if you and I, you know, we're together, we talk, we're in the center of the universe. If you walk away from me, you walk for every foot, you walk three, every foot you walk away, it's a nanosecond. 3 nanoseconds a meter, roughly. You walk away, you walk into my past, and from your past, you have a new center of the universe. Your redshifting process has done it. And then if we all get in a plane together and fly around, the universe redshifts, blue shifts on the outside to keep us always in the center. And this is part of it. If it's come from a point, it remains a point. And this really complex thing in that we are all interrelated. We're all the same. We are basically, there's only one electron field, but it's excited in many ways, many times to produce it. So it's like this fantastic, like the electron wave is a single membrane in space, multidimensional membrane, and you've hit it. And it's like this getting multiple notes out of a bell when you really clang it. It's all in space. So you've got all this complexity of space. And so the science answer, who's the center of the universe, is that everyone is at the center of the universe. And is there a benefit between the two? I think in the end there is, because when you look at it, and you look at the science questions, you sort of get a bit distracted. And when you walk back to the social systems, you go, the real issue is not who is at the centre. It's really clear who's at the centre. Queen Elizabeth I, Donald Trump, they're at the centre. They have the least requirement to justify, and they have the highest requirement to require justification. So you can do some sort of measures and say socially they are the centre. And you can also look at people locally the centre and how that local dynamics goes around them and how they have to adjust to do it. I suppose the question is how people can calculate and respond to it. One of the things is that the people who are most entrapped and respond, so people say, do a response to the centre, that is, a boss has told me to do this, I have to do this or I will get in trouble, or I can do this and therefore I can become a boss. So that's the way they do it. It's more the modelling of how, when you come from the science perspective and you come across, you look at more than modelling there, and you look at more people providing solutions and the issue of someone providing a solution. So often the solution is a very complex one, which requires you to do something, and you wind up doing something like building a church or being someone's friend or doing something, not stupid, but inputting into a system which sort of pushes it in a way which proves the people right in the first place. It's a fairly complicated thing. So that's my view as to who's the centre of the universe. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things
understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.